Saturday afternoon, session one.
Okay, so I'm just going to say a few things to pick up where we left off. And then I'm going to have Frank come in and talk a little bit. And yeah, then we'll just see what happens. So we left off in our last episode with Jeff leaving Sally. asking the question, why do you suffer? Again, so now we're going to take this seemingly esoteric topic and make it like incredibly practical. And really all because of grasping, because of attachment, I mean all the things, they all, again, we're trying to get to the truth. We're trying to get to the bottom. And so when we go down from attachment, grasping, or whatever, bum, it really does come down. We grasp because we think there's something to grasp after that's real. We are attached because we think there's something out there that's real. And so the fundamental reason we suffer is because we reify. And so this is really the endarkened view. This is not the enlightened view. This is the endarkened view. We live in the dark when we think things truly exist. And as I mentioned yesterday, and I riffed on this, so I'm not going to say a whole lot now, you know, this is the whole angle of why is life so hard, remember? Because we make it so. Life isn't hard, we are. And so by engaging in this enterprise of practice and study on these teachings on emptiness, you know, we're slowly melting, seeing through mere appearances. And I was thinking of over lunch, of a really quite practical way that one of the main reasons we suffer is we often take things personally. You know, it's either, oh, why did they do that? I mean, it's like Mark Twain once said, at least 50% of the things in my life actually didn't happen. 50% of adverse experiences in my life never really happened. That's amazing, isn't it, really? Mark Twain, I love this guy. And so, you know, I really look at your experience. We often are unsettled, anxious, when we take things personally, you know? And so I was thinking about this. Well, these teachings on emptiness actually get rid of all three of these ingredients. First of all, it goes after this thing called thing. So we're trying to, you know, get rid of this thingness and go to no thingness. And so if there's no thingness, then of course there's nothing to take, right? And then, you know, if you get rid of what's out there, if there's nothing out there in terms of things, the immediate, this is a bit subtle, but it's quite compelling. It's why Manjushri has two blades with his sword. And you can go out, you can go after either outer or inner, because they bootstrap each other. You can't have one without the other. So you can either use the teachings on emptiness to go out and destroy or cut through the appearance of other. This is what science does. This is what quantum mechanics does, general systems theory, chaos theory, complexity theory. I mean, all these incredibly sophisticated modern sciences fundamentally destroy the illusion of other. And even Tsongkhapa could go so far as to say that you can use these Western sciences to actually reveal the illusory nature of the physical world. But the blade also comes back in. And this is where you use things like the perceptual sciences, developmental and evolutionary psychology, cognitive science, neuroscience. And so what I do in this book that I just sent to my publisher is I do both. First of all, the first half of the book is all about emptiness, illusory form, and dream yoga. And the second half of the book is exactly that. The blade then goes out. And all the sciences that support this view. And so I'm not, you know, going to riff on all these sciences, because unless you're a scientist, you know, it may get a little boring for you. I totally groove on this stuff. But there is a lot of support, not just from the wisdom traditions, that really support this way of looking at things. And that is as it should be, because we're talking about reality. And you know, one science doesn't have exclusive domain over the exploration of reality. All these different traditions, Eastern, Western, inner, outer, scientific, psychological, soft, hard science, they all have contributions to make. And again, yet again, this is one reason I'm attracted to integral approaches. Because, you know, we can integrate all these different things. And so if you're having trouble understanding emptiness from a Buddhist point of view, Read chaos theory, complexity theory, systems theory, you know, quantum mechanics. Read about neuroscience, cognitive science, perceptual sciences. And they're all, you know, with close reading, they're all close to saying the same thing. So take things personally. Well, you know, there's nothing to take, so that's gone. External thinking is gone. And so, you know, once the thing out there is gone, we're always pinging. It's like a type of echolocation, whether we know it or not, like those bats. And like that blind kid, you know, who could and find his way through the world. We're always pinging. We're always sending something out subconsciously to ping against the seemingly external world to bring back an echo that somehow there locates us. And therefore, and this I find is extremely compelling, I think one of the principal reasons there's such an insatiable urge by the scientific community, the physicists and the quantum physicists, to find the irreducible particle out there is because if there is an irreducible particle out there, by immediate implication and very subtle definition, there has to be something here. You see? We define the sense of self by implication in contrast to other. And so once you ping through the other, then this pings apart. And this is why so many quantum physicists become mystics. It's not, in spite of their science, it's because of it. And the analogy I use, it's as if they look, they're looking, you know, through their super, super microscopes, their electron microscopes, string theory, whatever you want to call it, and pardon this kind of expression, but they're looking way, 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 way down the rabbit hole, as far, far, far down as they can go, and this is what they see. This is what Mother Nature is putting at you, because there's nothing out there. Really, if you study quantum mechanics, and not just dilettante, if you really study it, and if you are not shocked, and scientists say this, if you are not shocked by the implications of quantum mechanics, you don't understand it. In exactly the same way, if your ego not shocked by the implications of the teachings on emptiness, you don't understand it, at least initially. This is why in the historical unfolding of these teachings, when the Buddha taught these at Bodhgaya, allegedly against an archetypal number, 500 of his most senior students, 500 of his arhats, they all had cardiac arrest. Again, don't take it literally. But the teachings were so shocking. All the things that the Buddha had taught up until this point in his life, now, you know, he was basically chipping away, chipping away, chipping away, and yet there were still chips. You know, oh, we're chipping away, but the chips are still there. You know, chip, 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 oh yeah, it's all good, but there's still the chips, right? We can still put Humpty Dumpty back together. And then in the second turning, like I write in the chapters I sent you, he even points out that the chips themselves don't exist. So what you took apart in the first turning teachings, they're no longer even there. And from an egoic point of view, that's cardiac arrest time. Remember Sanford and Son? Remember? This really dates me. Remember? Sanford and Son?
This is the big one.
This is the big one. Remember? Remember? This is the big one. And so this is one reason I studied physics. After I got my degree in music, I studied physics. And I didn't know it at the time. But I was looking for reality, and I thought physics described reality. Well, physics describes physical reality. But you can still, again, in this fractal way, you can still use these incredible discoveries to help you point to this fundamental truth. And so I think, you know, physicists clamor. There's a psychological, I would argue, a psychological subliminal impetus to many of these scientists. They're sometimes called solid types. It's the shadow element of that level of articulation, where what they do, in my opinion, is they're trying to find other, an irreducible other, as a very subtle way by implication, to mean that, you know, if there's something out there, there has to be something in here, by implication. And so it doesn't matter which way you do it. If you get rid of one or the other because they co-emerge, they bootstrap each other, it doesn't matter which one you cut through. You cut through other, self falls apart. There, you know, if you cut through self, other falls apart. And so I do both. And actually the wisdom tradition does it as well. You know, there's dialectics and very interesting systems, but in my opinion, Western intellectual scientific disciplines are even more compelling to me. And so you fundamentally come to this conclusion, and again, there's so much unbelievable data here, and this is what I try to put in my book, that as John Wheeler, principal student of Einstein once provocatively said, there is no out there out there. And if there's no out there, There's no in here, in here. And then again, there's part of you that's like, hey, wait, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go here. Remember? Hands in the ears. This is exactly what happens when we go into deep dreamless sleep, because this truth is what's pointed out. And so as the ego's going down deeper, deeper into that rabbit hole, when it gets down there, the ego does this. And so when it's pointed out, what happens? Ego doesn't see it. Why? Because ego doesn't want to see it. This is why we go non-lucid and deep dreamless sleep. Because it points out every single night the formless, empty nature of our being. And ego puts its hands over its ears and eyes and does the ah thing and says, I don't want to go there. And so it doesn't. And so how does ego experience? How does the archetype of form experience formlessness? It doesn't. How does consciousness experience non-duality, wisdom? It doesn't. We literally go unconscious. We black out. So this is really important. This is why we don't experience deep dreamless sleep. And by further extension, eventually, this is why we don't experience lucidity in our dreams. It all comes down to these archetypal issues. And so if you want to have constancy and lucidity, this is the way you do it. You see? It's not, just this and this. This is the guts of the whole thing. And so I will read one last thing here, and then I will turn it over to Frank. This material, as I pointed out, I can't remember, somewhere in the scheme of things, not only is it intellectually challenging, and if you've studied this material, Taranatha, Ron's reading on Taranatha, it doesn't matter. If you actually study this stuff, it's intellectually difficult. It's one reason, as a total nerd, I love this stuff. I find it incredibly stimulating. So not only is it intellectually daunting, but more compellingly, more insidiously, it's emotionally daunting. Because, again, we have this bipolar thing. The clear light bandwidth of our identity longs for this, because this is the truth. This is what's really missing. This is what we want to return to. This is the beacon calling us home, way up here in the bandwidth of our identity. But way down here, because there's still the tail, the evolutionary tail, the caboose, down here, beige, red, infrared, there is a deep part that's fully reified, crystallized, the echo of our evolutionary legacy that doesn't want to go there. And so this is incredibly helpful and important to understand, because when you start taking the deep dive into this stuff, you will discover this bipolar relationship to it. Part of you, when I got into this stuff, I was manic. I could not get enough. And then I would want to vomit the next week. I would say, this is stupid, it's ridiculous, it's mere sophistry. In fact, I remember very clearly, you remember Bob Rader, Bill Sheen, Frank, I don't know if you remember him. These are some of my first two teachers. And I remember very, very clearly one day when I was first hearing this stuff. These are really great people, pretty smart. And they were demonstrating what's called Majjhimaka dialectic, which is a really fascinating kind of debate that we do. That's really, really cool. You might have seen videos where they do they wave these rosaries and then they do this slapping thing. It's a way that's sharpening the mind to cut. And so I remember they're going at it. They go, okay, we're going to give this thing. And of course, me being just a total, remember, I was a Joe Schmo Schmuck back then, right? Sorry, Joe. Sorry, Joe. I was a Bill Schmuck, Frank Schmuck. Andrew Schmuck. I take that very personally. Right? I don't take it personally. Because I don't take it at all. But the idea was they were going at it, and I found myself just getting really pissed off, just really irritated. And finally, really, I did. I said, excuse me, really. Excuse me, this is stupid. And I was just revealing my neurotic emotional aplasia upheaval because they were pointing something out that part of me just did not want to hear. And at that point, I am not exaggerating. I was in the back of the class, and I said, this is just dumb. Just cut to the quick. And they basically said, well, we are cutting to the quick. But they didn't say this, and that's why you can't deal with it. There's part of us that doesn't want to know the truth. We don't want to know the truth. And so, ego lives in this bed of lies, lives in this bed of deception. And so It's not only intellectually challenging, it's emotionally challenging. Really, there's a big part of you that just hates this stuff. And so I'm going to end with this little quote from Sogyal Rinpoche, and then I'll invite Frank to come up. This is what he says. It's quite beautiful. We are so addicted to looking outside ourselves that we have lost access to our inner being almost completely. We are terrified to look inward because our culture has given us no idea of what we will find. We may even think that if we do, we will be in danger of madness. This is one of the last and most resourceful ploys of ego to prevent us from discovering our real nature. And so we make our lives so hectic that we eliminate the slightest risk of looking into ourselves. End quote. What he talks about is beautiful. Active laziness. Active laziness. Oh, I don't have time for meditation. I don't have time for spirituality. I've got to deal with my kids. I've got to deal with fill in the blank. You know, I don't have time. I've got so much to do, so much to do, so much to do, so much to do. Active laziness. We don't want to go here. Even the idea of meditation can scare people. Ooh. Ooh. When they hear the words egoless or emptiness, they think that experiencing those states will be like being thrown out the door of a spaceship to float forever in a dark, chilling void. Nothing could be further from the truth. But in a world dedicated to distraction, to non-lucidity, dedicated to distraction, silence and stillness terrify us. Maybe this is why it's been a little hard to be quiet here, you know? The need to fill space, to make space. Silence and stillness terrify us. We protect ourselves from them with noise and frantic busyness. Looking into the nature of our mind is the last thing we would dare to do. And so, of course, then what this intimates, what it suggests, is what do? We spend our entire lives looking away. Distraction therapy, the outsider's trajectory, seduced by light, seduced by sight, seduced by the outside. You know, I ain't going in there. I ain't going into the dark. No, no, no. No, no, no. And so what do? We're constantly, and it's way beyond the scope of what we're doing here, but at SMC, when we talk about the Bardo teachings, we talk about this particular outward impetus at its genesis. Like in the karmic Bardo becoming, where it comes from, how it is that we throw ourselves out. Moment to moment, thought to thought, life to life, Bardo to Bardo. You know, that the Bardo teachings describe just that in tremendous detail, but it's largely about this avoidance strategy, avoidance of the truth. And so we're going out, we're constantly going out, constantly going out. Why do we go out? Because we think there's something out there to go to. The winds, the subtle winds blow us out, literally. When the mind attends to an object, it does so through the movement of these subtle winds. They are the winds that propel us from the heart, eventually into the throat, into the head, and then out into the external world. And so these winds literally blow us away from ourselves. And so what we have to do is, I mean, look at how much is against us here to discover the truth. Our culture is against it. Social constructions are against it. Even our biology is against it. Everything has co-conspired for millennia to keep us away from the truth. And that's why it's so hard to wake up. This is why it's so hard to become utterly lucid in the deepest sense. Because all these incredibly sophisticated matrices co-conspire to basically keep us in the dark. And so this is incredibly helpful to understand. When you turn within and you try to find the truth, you are going against the tide, a stampede of all these forces. But sooner or later, and it's happening, this stampede is heading towards a cliff. And it is in fact falling off that cliff. Look at what's happening to our world. So do we capitulate, go with the herd, which is what most people do? Why? Because it's so easy. It's just, this is the easy way. Or do we, you know, turn against the tide, little small communities of like-minded people, and have the courage, the warriorship, to look within? And again, by understanding the enemy, Sun Tzu, Art of War, know thy enemy. By understanding the enemy and all its components, my third book, you can transform that enemy into a near friend. That's the alchemy. And you can now use those very matrices that project you out. You can transform them into directors that bring you back in. Okay? All right. Frank, are you good?
I'm always good.
Are you basically good? Come on up, man. I don't have too much hair left to pull out. I have to be really careful. Grazie, amigo. Do you want some water? I'll make you some water.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you. We did a 1 minute stretch.
Just stand up.
I'm going to, but I'd say it's. I'm walking into the room. Well, actually, we were going to sit for a minute, but if you prefer to stretch, I don't think anyone will object. I really don't know how this works. Do I have it? Is that good? Okay. Let's sit for a minute in silence. If you like, you can go back to the practice that Andrew guided us in yesterday. Just immediately go to the raised gaze, the feeling of letting your mind expand into the space, letting thoughts come and go freely without grasping them, and resting as much as you can in the awareness itself without coming back to any supports such as breath or body. And this practice will give us a taste of what I will try to describe a traditional teaching in words. So let's just sit like that now for a minute. Is it?
Maybe.
Is that better?
Yes.
Good. Yesterday, see if I pronounce it properly, Russian? Mm-hmm. Russian quoted a line from Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. And amazing coincidence, I was preparing my talk the night before and decided that I wanted to begin the talk by reading the entire speech that one line is from. She and Andrew kind of synchronistically spoke the most famous line, but the entire speech is actually very, very beautiful. I don't want to get into a talk about Shakespeare, but I do love Shakespeare. When I was in college,
I was an English major, and I thought that I was going to become a college professor, and that I was going to teach Shakespeare. Trungpa Rinpoche had other ideas. But I had never lost my love of Shakespeare. And this particular soliloquy, as it were, is the first of all, The Tempest is his last play. It is, historians of Shakespeare consider it his farewell to the stage. And he wrote it not too long before his death. And this is the last major poetic utterance of that play. And the main character, who is named Prospero, is basically a magician, among other things. He's actually the Duke of Milan, but he has magical powers in the sense that he can summon spirits. And in this little soliloquy at the very end of the play, what he has just done is he has created a beautiful mask, M-A-S-Q-U-E, a dance of spirits in honor of his daughter Miranda's wedding. And then he abruptly ends it, almost right in the middle, kind of shockingly, he ends it. And then he gives this soliloquy, which is basically, if you listen to it, it's about a dream within a dream within a dream. Or if you like, a play within a play within a play. Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. What I would like to do in the next few minutes is present to you a teaching which I and many other students received from our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, while he was teaching in the West. It's a very, very old teaching from Tibet. Actually, it originated in India, but it came to Tibet and it was passed down from generation to generation for 1,000 years. And this teaching is referred to as the Slogans of Atisha. So it is one of the sections of the teachings of the Slogans of Atisha. Now, I may not have been here, but I had the sense that Andrew mentioned Atisha to you in one of his talks. No?
No.
Okay. Atisha was a great meditation master from India. And he was invited to come to Tibet, probably in the 11th century, to teach the Tibetans. Being an Indian master, he was from a tradition called Pandits, P-A-N-D-I-T, who were great intellects, great logicians, incredibly sharp prajna, the sort of manjushri, the prajna, intellectual prajna, prajna which could see and analyze experience very, very clearly. And this was a very long-standing tradition since the lifetime of the Buddha, that his teachings were studied and analyzed and expounded upon in India for more than 1,000 years before they made their way to Tibet. And Atisha originally thought that when he came to Tibet, he would teach the Tibetans in the same way that he taught the students at Nalanda in India, the great university. But when he got to Tibet, he discovered that the Tibetans were not in the least bit interested in this logical, intellectual, very sharp, very, very sophisticated approach to studying emptiness. In fact, they had no idea what he was talking about. And they found it to be, from their point of view, gibberish. It was, I can only imagine that it was their, like their equivalent of saying to him, "Where's the beef?" And so he realized that he had to find a different way to communicate to the Tibetans. And I should say parenthetically, for those of you who are interested at all in the way that the Dharma came from India to Tibet, that the first great meditation master to bring the Dharma to Tibet was Padmasambhava. And he was preceded by several great teachers from India who, like Atisha, had been trained in this very intellectual approach. And they tried to establish monasteries in Tibet, and there were earthquakes. Everything they tried to do was destroyed. And it took a teacher like Padmasambhava, Guru Rinpoche, to find a way to communicate with the Tibetans on their own terms and in their own language, which actually was, in a certain way, very, very magical. As we talked about the Dralas a few days ago. What he did was he made friends with their spirits. He made friends with their spirit world and conquered them, turned them into the Dharma. But that's another story. Atisha decided that in order to teach the Tibetans about emptiness, he needed to find a more direct approach. And this direct approach came in the form of slogans. That's the translation that Chogyam Trungpa generally used. Another word that he used as a synonym for slogans was commands. Command. Like, you give the student a command, a very simple command about how to regard their experience. And another even more interesting word that he used as a synonym for a slogan or command was mantra. Now, I don't know if folks here know the literal meaning of mantra. But it's very interesting. The literal meaning of mantra is mind protection. Man is mind, comes from the Sanskrit manas, and tra is to protect. So what is it that a mantra protects? How does a mantra protect the mind? A mantra protects the mind. It protects it from confusion. It protects it from having a distorted view. It protects it from straying from clear, truthful understanding of how things are. So this particular teaching is going to describe the mantras or slogans or commands of emptiness. It is said that the difference between a Buddha and an ordinary person is what's called the two veils. And Andrew referred to these a few days ago. The two veils, V-E-I-L-S. Or sometimes, in more technical language, they're called the two obscurations. I like the word veil, because it has that wonderful quality that if you can lift the veil that stands between you and understanding how things truly are, all you have to do is lift the veil and the truth will appear. So, there are two veils that separate ordinary people from Buddhas. The first is called the veil of conflicting emotions, or kleshas. Sometimes kleshas are translated as literally torturous emotions. We're tortured by them. They're toxic. They're arising bring suffering. Anger and hatred. Grasping, desperate passion. Envy, jealousy, paranoia. Pride and arrogance. Denial, numbness, and stupidity. So there I've named the five main classes of klesha that you find within the Tibetan tradition. But all of them share the fact that they are inherently painful to experience and to receive. So they're painful for the one who puts them out, and they're painful for the one who receives them. That's the first veil. The second veil is called the veil of primitive beliefs about reality. The veil of primitive beliefs about reality. This veil is the veil of believing in a separate, solid, independent, centralized self. or what the great masters call simply the I thought. The I thought. These are the primitive beliefs about reality. Now, the connection between these two veils is that because we believe that the I is real, we defend it, and we defend it with our pleasures. So, in this non-existent castle of ego fixation, what is at the center is this illusory but extremely persuasive sense of me. And then in order to keep that in business, to keep it in place, we send out the tentacles of klesha, which keeps it alive. So far so good? So far so bad? Okay. Okay, so we have the two veils. In the Tibetan tradition, and this is where Atisha's genius, in terms of bringing these teachings, he brought them so directly to deal with the two veils, basically. They are the teachings of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is one of the most important words in the entire tradition of Buddha Dharma. Bodhicitta, again, Andrew has referred to this a few times. Bodhicitta literally means awakened heart, awakened mind, or if you prefer, awakened mind heart, heart mind, with the understanding that the deepest experience of mind is also the heart. So rather than the thinking mind, it's the heart mind, the true nature. The basic teaching is that in order to remove these two veils, and in order for an ordinary person to eventually become a Buddha, the practice of bodhicitta will suffice. It will take us the whole way. So in keeping with counteracting these two veils, there are two kinds of bodhicitta. There's what's called the relative bodhicitta, and the ultimate bodhicitta. So you can see that the tradition is very, very precise. The relative bodhicitta is the aspect of bodhicitta that we use to transform our kleshas, our painful, toxic, tortured emotions that keep ego alive, to transform those emotions into love and compassion. The practice of relative bodhicitta is sometimes called transforming poison into medicine. The poison is the kleshas, the medicine is love and compassion. How many of you are familiar with the practice of Tonglen? Tonglen is the most direct, powerful method for transforming poison into medicine. Many Tibetan masters have said that through Tonglen alone, one can become enlightened. Ultimate bodhicitta. Oh, one brief thing. Since we're not going to describe the slogans of relative bodhicitta in any detail today, because that's not the purpose of the exercise. We want to talk about the teaching of emptiness. But before we leave the teachings of love and compassion and relative bodhicitta, I'll just give you one slogan. And those of you who have studied these will be very familiar with this. I tried to pick one slogan of all the many that there are about relative bodhicitta that I thought expressed it the most powerfully. And that one, for me, goes like this: be grateful to everyone. Be grateful to everyone. Be grateful to everyone is a slogan for transforming the poison of klesha into medicine of love and compassion, because everyone includes the people we can't stand. the people who irritate us, the people who threaten us, the people who are unkind to us, and on and on. To be grateful to these people, for this to be your practice, is the quick path to enlightenment. I'm not going to say more than that. I'll leave you to contemplate it. Be grateful to everyone. Hint, take back your projections. I was saying more. What I want to focus on now is the heart of this talk is the slogans of Ultimate Bodhicitta. Whereas the slogans of Relative Bodhicitta are about transforming the poison of kleshas into the medicine of love and compassion, the slogans of Ultimate Bodhicitta are about seeing the true nature, seeing the true nature, seeing directly what the true nature is. And this is where emptiness comes in. Seeing through our primitive beliefs about reality. Our primitive beliefs about reality are that we assume, and almost every waking moment of our lives keeps fortifying and reinforcing this assumption that there is a real world out there separate from us, and that there is a real me in here who is having all these experiences. The Tibetan masters call this primitive beliefs about reality. So, Atisha said, here are five commands, five slogans, five commands, five mantras, five mind protectors that will help you over time cut through your primitive beliefs about reality and experience what emptiness truly means and set you free. So there are five slogans. The first three are slogans that refer to the view. Andrew talked about the meaning of view. View is having a perspective, having a clear understanding, like a map, an aerial perspective on where these slogans are taking us, what they're for. So three of the five are slogans of the view. So the view is very important. The fourth slogan is about how to meditate once you understand the view. And the fifth slogan is how to conduct yourself when you get up off the cushion and live your life. The first three are the view, the fourth is the meditation, the fifth is the action. There's a famous saying in Tibet. If you have the view, but not the meditation, I'll start the other way. If you have the meditation, but not the view, you are like a blind man walking in a vast space. You don't know where you're going. You're walking, but you don't know where you're going. If you have the view and not the meditation, then you are like a rich man who does not know how to use his riches. You're like a rich man who is a miser. Another way it's sometimes described, the view is like the eyes and the meditation is the legs. And together they will take us exactly where we need to go. Chogyam Trungpa had a more colorful way of putting it. He said, those who study without meditating, study the Dharma without meditating, become neurotic scholars. Those who meditate without studying the Dharma become dumb meditators. So here are the three slogans of of the view. The first one says, regard all dharmas as dreams. And it's this first slogan, when Andrew asked me a few months ago before the program, he very kindly asked me if I would like to give a talk on emptiness. And I initially freaked out because I did not want to give a talk about Madhyamaka or all those super sophisticated ways of talking about emptiness. But I thought of the slogans and I thought how the first one was about dreams. And I thought, that's it. That's how I can connect with the many different ways that he has been unfolding the theme of dreams over this past 5 days. So the first slogan says, regard all dharmas as dreams. The first point here is to understand what is specifically meant by dharmas in this command, in this mantra. So I will distinguish it in terms of capital D dharma and little d dharma. Capital D dharma is the dharma that taught by the Buddha. The teachings of the Buddha, the way, the truth of things as they are. That's big D dharma. Little d dharma refers to phenomena. It refers to everything that it is possible for us to experience. In the Hindu tradition in India, it had many other meanings too, but it's not necessary to go into them all. The point is to be really clear about the difference between the big D dharma, which is the teaching, and the little d dharma, which simply refers to phenomena, refers to whatever is possible for us to experience. So in using the word phenomena, we are talking about the world that we create with our mind and then externalize, and all of its details. These are the dharmas, everything that's possible for us to experience. So in meditation, the dharmas are everything that we could possibly experience. Our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, our bodily sensations, the whole range of our sense perceptions, the stories that we tell ourselves with our thoughts and emotions, our memories, our speculations about the future. All of this is the constant arising of the complexity of dharmas. What is the instruction? Regard them all as being like dreams. And again, to paraphrase something Andrew said this morning, when we're able to see them as dreams, we are free. We are free. We see the dreamlike quality and we are free. Pema Chodron put it this way, everything we experience is immediately a memory. Everything we experience is a passing memory. The moment we experience it is already gone, like the imprint of a bird in the sky. Everything we experience is utterly impermanent, utterly insubstantial. To really, really take this to heart is to regard all dharmas as dreams. So what does this do? This enables us to begin to relax and dissolve the tight fixation we have on the world as real and its manifestations as real, as solid, as hard. Regard all dharmas as dreams. Second slogan's a little bit more subtle in a way. It goes like this. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Oh, hypothetically, or parenthetically, excuse me. There's a great teaching in Tibet, I think I heard it from Thai Sitra Rinpoche, at least 30 years ago. He talked about the three levels of dream, and this is a really good way to regard dharmas as dreams as well. He said there are three levels of dream. They're kind of like nesting Russian dolls. He didn't say that, I just said that. The first level of dream is the dream we have when we go to sleep at night, and it ends when we wake up in the morning. The second level of dream, and this is extremely pertinent to what Andrew's been teaching for the last 5 days, Second level of dream is the dream we have of this life, and it ends at the moment of death. I'm going to say that one again. Second level of dream is the dream that we are having of this life, each of us, this life, and it ends at the moment of death. The third level of dream is the dream of samsara, and it ends at the moment that we become enlightened. So, like nesting dolls, the night dream, the life dream, the samsaric dream, are a dream within a dream within a dream. Like those beautiful lines from The Tempest. So, whatever arises in the mind, don't cling, don't grasp. Let it come, let it go. Touch and go. Regard all dharmas as dreams. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Now we turn the sword of Manjushri, the lens of Manjushri, the sharp, sharp microscope of Manjushri, back toward the meditator, the one who is experiencing these dharmas. Having reduced the dharmas to dreamlike status, now we turn toward the one who is having the dream. And we ask, who's having this dream? And the more we meditate, the more we meditate on this, the more we rest with this question, the more we will come to certainty that we cannot find anyone who is having this dream. We cannot find the I, we cannot find the me beyond a thought or a cluster of thoughts. So the I thought or the cluster of thoughts is like camouflage over space. And we're hypnotized by the camouflage. But if we examine the nature of unborn awareness over time, gradually, and then at times very suddenly and very powerfully, we see that the I is a fiction. It is not actually there. The key word here is unborn. Unborn awareness. Unborn means it never had a beginning. If it never had a beginning, it will never have an end. If it was never born, it cannot die. So when we turn that lens back toward the meditator and look deep, very, very deeply at the experience, we cannot find the I, the me. We cannot find that centralized self that is having this dreamlike experience. So what is being perceived is unreal. The perceiver is unreal, which leads us to the third slogan. And this is a really important slogan. This slogan says, there's two ways of saying it. This is a more kind of technical way of saying it. I'm going to give you one, and then if you like the other one better, you can write it down. Self-liberate even the antidote. So you can write that one down if you like. And the other way of saying it is, and this is the translation of a wonderful translator of the Atisha's slogans. He was a very close student of Kala Rinpoche, wonderful translator. His name is Kim McLeod. And his translation was, let even the remedy go free on its own, which I kind of like better. Let even the remedy go free on its own. So whichever you prefer. The important thing is the meaning of these slogans. Whichever way we put it, it has the same meaning. The meaning is, don't cling to emptiness either. Don't cling to unreality either. Don't turn emptiness, unreality, the non-existence, the dreamlike quality, don't turn that into something real. If you do, it's called the poison of emptiness. The great Siddha Saraha said, Those who believe that the self and the world are real are stupid like cattle. Those who believe that the self and the world don't exist at all are even stupider. So that's an emptiness punchline, guys. That's the Sarahan nightclub from nearly 2,000 years ago. No one has improved on that. Sorry. Those who believe things are real are stupid like cattle. Those who believe that things are unreal are even stupider. In other words, don't make emptiness into your new God. Emptiness doesn't exist either. Here's an analogy that helps us understand that. One shore is samsara, the other shore is liberation. We sit in the boat of emptiness and row from one shore to the other. Emptiness will take us from one shore of samsara to the shore of liberation. But when we get out of the boat, we don't start carrying it on our back as we walk in the land of liberation. We put the boat down at the shore. We don't need the boat. The importance of this is that we begin to see that emptiness, above all, is a method. It is a method for setting us free. The Buddha once said that to become enlightened is simply to abandon, is the art of abandoning our delusions. In other words, it's not about adding anything to our experience, that we're going to accumulate and get to enlightenment. No, we're going to simplify. We're going to remove the veils. It is the art of abandoning our delusions. What do I mean by the poisons of emptiness? Very important. And Andrew talked about this, I think maybe yesterday. He said, if we misunderstand emptiness, we fall into the trap of nihilism. In terms of these teachings, the trap of nihilism means for embracing the ultimate and rejecting or forgetting the relative. In other words, taking emptiness literally is poison because it cuts us off from love and compassion. Nihilism, that nothing matters. No thing. It's not that nothing matters, no thing matters, right? So I think that pun, no thing, nothing matters is a trap that's called the poison of emptiness. And we lose the connection with love and compassion. And without love and compassion, bodhicitta is incomplete. It is one-sided. It cannot take us to liberation. So, let the remedy go free on its own. Self-liberate the antidote means don't hang on to emptiness either. Don't carry the boat with you. It's much too strenuous. You don't need that much weight. You make emptiness into too big a deal. It's not a big deal. It's the sword of Manjushri. It cuts through. You're cut in half and you don't even know it happened. It's not messy at all. Okay. Slogan number 4. This is the slogan of meditation. Just one slogan about how to meditate once you've understood the view. One slogan. This slogan says, rest in the alaya, the essence. Rest in the alaya, the essence. Alaya is A-L-A-Y-A. Alaya. Now, yesterday at the end of the afternoon session, Andrew was talking about the eighth consciousness and the seventh consciousness. Technically speaking, the alaya is the eighth consciousness, but in meditation it's meant in a particular way. Generally, the alaya, as the source, you could say the unconscious basis of our karma, the unconscious basis of mind, the eighth consciousness, is activated by the seventh constantly. The seventh is what my teacher called, and I don't know if you used this term yesterday, Andrew, the klesha consciousness. And basically the seventh takes the eighth to be a me, an I, and then generates kleshas in order to protect the I. Then the eighth, this is a little technical, but it's interesting and important. Then the eighth becomes what's called the alaya vijnana. Did you talk about that yesterday? Vijnana means divided knowing. V is divided, jnana is knowing. It means dualistic consciousness. As long as the alaya becomes dualistic in our experience, we can't use it to meditate. But when our grasping at thoughts and memories and storylines and emotions and experiences of all kind, when that begins to settle and subside, then the alaya becomes the basis for what is ultimately called the clear light mind. Here's a wonderful analogy again from my teacher, Chogyam Trungpa. He said, resting in the alaya is like going to a movie. You sit in the dark theater. The movie is projected on the screen. And he said, the film in the projector and the images on the screen by which we become mesmerized. We suspend disbelief and we become totally a part of that projected world. Those are the dharmas that we need to regard as real life. The projector that is putting those images up is the I thought. But the thing that is making the whole thing visible to us is the bulb. And he said, the bulb is shining through this illusion of the projector, the film, and the projection. And we, in the theater, are completely engrossed in the drama that's taking place. But the bulb, which has illuminated the entire thing and made it possible for us to even experience it, is totally unaffected and unstained by any of the images of the film that go past it over and over. So his instruction was, when you meditate, rest in the bulb. Rest in the bulb. Rest in the light of the bulb. Do not move from the bulbness. Do not move from the illumination, the knowing quality, the lucid quality of your awareness, which shines through all of your temporary experiences and illuminates them for what they are. So don't be caught by the projections, don't be caught in the projector, but just rest in the bulb. I think that's a pretty good metaphor for the meditation of resting in the alaya. And so again, as the guided meditation went yesterday, the instruction is to rest the mind in that sense of openness, allow experience to come and go, and ultimately, look directly at who is meditating and see that there's nothing to be found. And then rest in that unborn awareness, which is the bulb, which is shining eternally. It was never born, it can never die. The final slogan is called the slogan of conduct, or the slogan of action, so or slogan of post-meditation, which is actually how this slogan or command begins. So the final slogan, number 5, says, in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. That might be my favorite slogan. It's just so beautiful. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. the image that's traditionally used here is in your engagement with the world, be like a child, a young child entering into a beautiful temple for the first time. The child has no idea what he or she is looking at in terms of its history, its genealogy, who painted it. The child, well, it's like Costco, right? So that's the updated. I prefer the temple wall, it's more elegant. You're just looking as if for the first time at everything that you experience. There's no trace of memory in the sense of making your perception based on comparison. You're experiencing each thing just as it is, as much as possible. Chogyam Trungpa called this first thought, best thought. First thought, best thought, which he said is a slogan for artists, poets, musicians. You know, that initial inspiration is so fresh. Stay with that as much as you can. Don't overthink it. Don't become overly self-conscious. Rely on first thought, best thought. Be a child of illusion. Be free and uninhibited. Be carefree. Carefree is a word that the Dzogchen masters love to use. In terms of meditation, in terms of conducting your life, be carefree, be relaxed, experiencing everything as if for the first time. Trungpa Rinpoche, the image he used here is he said, when you get up from the cushion and go out into your life, take the bulb out of the projector and put it in your flashlight. And go out into the world with your flashlight and your lantern, with the bulb of unborn awareness wherever you go. He was something. He was something. Never forgetting the dreamlike quality of experience. And the word that's used here is be a child of illusion. It's interesting, it doesn't say be a child of dreams. The dreams were for the meditative state, illusion here. And I believe, maybe Andrew will have something to say about this before it's all over, but that this probably refers to illusory body, taking the practice out into the world and constantly experiencing the illusory quality of your own seemingly solid existence. So this is the child of illusion. And that's my talk. I'll take one or two questions if there are any at all. Yes.
This isn't a question, but can I tell a little tiny story that talks about the child in the
way? Sure.
And maybe it applies and maybe it doesn't really. But this really happened. I was in Seattle with my little children. And I didn't raise them with any kind of church consciousness. They'd never been in a place. And we went to a festival of the Greek cathedral that was in the center of Seattle. And for some reason, the cathedral was open. And so we said, oh, let's go in here. And we walked into this Greek cathedral with all of the stained glass and the icons and all of that. And my kids, or like that baby in Bethlehem. They're like, Mom, what is this place? They were just, they were totally, totally fascinated with that aesthetic beauty. It was really
cool. How old were your children when this happened?
Probably 6, 8.
Yeah.
8, 10.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm not that far.
Thank you. Michael.
Is that all in your book?
I'm sorry?
What are you taught us today? Is that in your book?
No, it's not. It's in several other books, which I can tell you about at dinner time.
Can we say this to summarize everything by saying everything and everyone, everywhere, all the time, in every state of consciousness is God? Oh, Spirit, we are it. Everything, There is no nothing that isn't it. Emptiness is it, form is it. And I mean, knowing that makes me want to celebrate.
Yeah, the only potential pitfall there is the itness of it. In other words, that itness, which often happens if we get, if we start trying to equate it with God, we have this sort of objectified reference point, which then takes it out of that fluidity, which is one of the reasons that, you know, Buddhism is called a non-theistic religion, because it's not as if it doesn't point to an experience which, when people have it, they might end up calling it God, but from the point of view of the one who is resting in unborn awareness, God would ultimately arise as a persistent, subtle concept, which also needs to be let go of. Because the reality, in other words, the emptiness is cutting through any attempt to hold on to a conceptual interpretation of our experience. And then we're left with the brilliance of our experience. And in a way, at that point, to talk about God is like painting a lily white. The lily's already white. The lily already speaks for itself. The lily is already, you know, there's a poem by Tennyson, flower in a crannied wall. I pluck you out from among the crannies and hold you in my hand. Little flower, if I could understand what you are, all in all, stem and all, and all in all, then I should know what God and man is. You know, you don't have to know what God and man is, you just have to know what the flower is. And also, I was always bothered by that because he pulls the flower out and then it's going to die. You know, why couldn't he just look at the flower? No, I got to pluck it out, flower. And, oh my God, you're changing right before my eyes. Anyway, Michael, do you follow what I'm saying? Spirit gets closer to it, but any word that we use to reify, again, the word that Andrew's been using all through this, to reify the vividness and the suchness and the ungraspableness of our direct experience of reality, dilutes it a tiny bit. And then we end up surviving on our memory constantly instead of fresh, constantly fresh. Thank you, sir. Before we close, I would like, if everyone is up for it, to sing a little song together. You all know this song, and it's very simple, and it will only take us a couple of minutes. The song goes like this. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. All right, so here's how we're going to do it. I thought about this for a long time. I'm not a choir master, but I realized that if I didn't think this out very carefully before I asked you to do it, it'd be total chaos. There's going to be some chaos anyway. There's four lines. Right? Row, row, row your boat, first line. Gently down the stream, second line. Merrily, 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 third line. Life is but a dream, fourth line. We're going to have four sections to the choir. So, between the two of you, this is section one. You're going to begin it. Row, row, row your boat. Then you're going to continue, and as they start singing gently down the stream, this whole group is going to start rowing. Then, when the first group starts singing merrily, 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 you're going to sing row, row, row your boat. Oh, and don't stop with row, row, keep going, right? Otherwise, we don't have a round. And then finally, when they're singing life is but a dream, you all start row, row, row your boat, and we're going to do it three times. So, we'll just do it. Any questions? Is that fairly? So there's the line between three and four, right on, Jace.
What should I sing?
Whichever you want, Jace.
Oh, okay.
All right. Are we ready? Let's get. I can't really go any more than 10 minutes. That's all right, let's just do it. You ready? Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
Here. I'm going to go outside and play with the child of illusion.
May I use my person to collect the money?
Yes.
Would you be willing to do this?
Sure.
Tell me your first name.
Karen.
Karen. Thank you, Karen.
Uh-huh.
Appreciate it. So it is, I'm not going to use a mic. It is customary after teaching such as this to offer, in addition to the teacher's honorarium, which any of you will receive from the proceeds of this program, it's customary to offer a teacher's gift to express our appreciation for the tremendous scholarship, exertion, passion, I don't need to tell you, that he embodies as a teacher. This kind of incandescent, encyclopedic, irrepressible, exuberant brilliance, right? Something like that. So, over the next, between now and, well, this is a really good point. Were we thinking of giving it to him at the end of the thing tonight? All right, so.
Or tomorrow.
Well, a lot of us are going to be leaving tomorrow. So, at maybe at the very end, at 9 o'clock tonight, we could offer this to him. Between now and 9 o'clock tonight, if you are inspired to do so, we are using Karen as our point person. Raise your hand, dear. See? Please give her the gift that you wish to make to Andrew, and we will present it to him. Well, do people have any preference about when it gets presented to him? My bias is, I have a bias because Nan and I are leaving first thing tomorrow, and I will not be here. It seems like a number of people may be leaving. So by 9 o'clock tonight, does that seem like a good time? And so we have all the dinner hour and all the rest of it to, if you want to make that contribution, to go back to your room and, you know, cash, check, whatever. And they'll all be collected, and then we'll give it to them formally at the end of the program tonight. Does that sound good? Are there any questions about that? Yes, Jace? You can do anything you want. Money's always good. But, you know, sometimes folks, if they can't make a gift of money, they, you know, you can write him a letter of appreciation, whatever you like, definitely. I have the card, but I'm going to give it back to you, okay? Hold on, let me get the card.
Oh, Andrew.
It's a wonderful card. This probably refers to some particular creature that I don't know his name. Is this Jeremiah? It's a bullfrog with a crown on his head. King of the frogs. And it reminded her of Andrew for some reason. So we'll put all the donations inside here somehow. It'll probably be bulging out. And we will present it to him. Does anyone here have a Tibetan silk scarf that they might have by some chance brought with them? You do. All right, that would be good. And do we have a plate that's more elegant than the plates we eat our meals off of?
Kitchenette, I guess.
A what?
Kitchen?
Kitchen.
Yeah. Would anybody be willing to be the finder of the plate? Okay, you're the finder of the plate, you're the bringer of the kata, you're the collector of the gifts. And would anyone like to formally present it to Andrew, or would you like me to? How should we do that? You would? All right, sir. You are on tonight. All right? So, Karen, we will eventually give the whole shebang to Jose, and he will present it to Andrew. With Karen.
No.
It's going to be hard for everyone to sign. Maybe we should just have
I don't think signing it's really going to work.
Yeah.
I think that would be the best. There are, at least 40 of us in this room, and there's not room for 40 here. There just
is. You will write a general, your beautiful description of Andrew.
Would you like me to do that?
Yes.
All right.
From all of us.
All right, I will simply say, in honor of the king of the bullfrogs.
Maybe we can do a group picture then in the evening.
Maybe we can.
Send it later to him.
Maybe we can. All right. Are there any other questions or concerns about how we're going to pull this off? I think it's going to be just really quite lovely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you.
You can
thank
that and write whatever you'd like in it then.
All right. I will do that. I'll do that right now during the break. Okay. If you want to write something to Andrew, yes. Yes, and you can put it on a separate piece of paper and fold it over if you made a cash gift, whatever. All right? Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's highly unlikely we're going to be able to put everybody's offerings inside this card. They'll all